And we are back with episode 702 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and I guess it shouldn't come to as any surprise that this year, of course, that section would become the greatest.
Indeed, indeed. 2016, what are you doing? Ugh. George R. R. Martin, stop writing 2016, get back to the Winds of Winter.
Absolutely.
All right, well, we have what is a relatively short news week this week, which means we will probably be getting into at least some of the episodic discussion by the end of this hour, but before we do any of that, Edmund, if you will, please.
Certainly. We like to spoil you about all sorts of things. If it's the news, we hope you enjoy it. If it's episodes we might get to, we hope you've seen them.
That's right. And certainly with a little bit less on the docket for episodic discussion, too, well, it's a little bit easier to catch up, right? Especially with all these finales and stuff going on. But yes, we have some news that is coming out of all kinds of different locales and locations. And the first one is one that I'm sure is going to be of great interest and debate, to say the least. And that is some more news regarding the reshoots of Rogue One, A Star Wars Story. Now, I don't know if we actually got around to mentioning that particular story last week. Did we, Edmund?
I don't think we did, actually.
No, I don't think so either, but I guess better late than never. We are going to go ahead and talk about some of the rumors. I want to say, first of all, these are rumors. We don't know if they're true. And in fact, I've seen at least two or three articles that either corroborate or completely go against what we have in this article. So I don't know if it's true or not, but it has, shall we say, the ring of truth. Okay. All right. So earlier in the week, we found out that the Rogue One film was going to go back for reshoots, supposedly to fix the tone, lighten the mood, make it more like a typical Star Wars movie. It made it sound like things maybe weren't too bad, but apparently things may be a little bit more substantial when it comes to the reshoots. Now, this is normal. I mean, Edmund, you can back up this statement because we've talked about it how many times, right? Movies, especially big budget movies, go for reshoots all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no,
they normally don't go back to correct quote-unquote 40% of the film, though.
No.
Yeah, that's so, what makes this a little much.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, on these big budget films, they are putting various rough cuts together, and one thing, when you have that much money to toss around, it does make it easier to make the decision to just go back and reshoot it rather than try and find something else and try and piece it together out of the footage you've got. If the rumors are true and they are talking about redoing this much of the movie, that is pretty extreme. And especially initially talking about 4 weeks of shooting, now talking about naturally with that much of the film, 8 weeks of shooting, which in some cases you can pretty much shoot a regular size movie in. That's a little worrisome. And I know personally, if Gary was here, I'm sure he might disagree, being the more family friendly fan among us. But the rumors that it may have had to do with the film being too dark and too much of a war story, and they wanted to go back and make it a little more, not quite as dark, although certainly given the, since this is leading into A New Hope, it is kind of hard to imagine that, you can't make that, you have to make this something of a war story. There are some pretty major battles and an alliance and a rebellion getting knocked back on its heels. So, we shall have to see, but let's just hope what we see at the end of the year doesn't show the problem of too many chefs stirring this broth.
Yeah, so let's talk about some of these things here, right? So supposedly J.J. Abrams is supervising the reshoots. Gareth Edwards is doing the reshoots himself, but with a partner, Christopher McQuarrie. McQuarrie was the final writer on Rogue One and will be working extensively with Edwards on the set to make sure they are supposedly on the same page with most of the recent drafts of the film. The draft supposedly being considered superior to the film that was previously shot, but that's supposedly not Edwards' fault because the draft wasn't completed when much of the film was shot, and the revisions kept coming in that made the film feel quote-unquote uneven. So they've been recreating sets for the reshoot, and it could take some substantial time, like 2 months of constant shooting, which again, if you read between the lines, and I know that McQuarrie has said back and forth, no, that's not the case. Yes, that is the case, and so on. The fact of the matter is that so much of this kind of film has to be done with you know, like a second draft, a third draft. And yeah, you're going to have these situations come up. Civil War was being went through some significant reshoots. And I got to say, seeing it a couple times now, you really can't see the seams anywhere. So this is normal. This is normal. I'm not surprised that they don't want this to be too dark of a film. They want something a little bit more what the audience is used to. I do kind of balk a little bit at the whole idea that this is going to ruin the film, although I have expressed my concern that Edward's vision may be, shall we say, watered down. I don't want every single Star Wars film to be just homogenous and the same, which especially those who have been critical of Episode 7. Yeah, we don't want Episode 8 or Rogue One to be exactly what we saw again. So, but these changes don't surprise me. I mean, they fast-tracked this movie so much. Mm-hmm. Ed, how about you? Anything about what was there that seems surprising or shocking?
Yeah, I guess the issue is more just this whole bizarre trend of of them going into shooting major films like this without really having a script completely nailed down. That's the part that I think is more of an issue. Is sort of the studios getting the cart before the horse and insisting on getting a cast in place, getting a director in place, getting the production up and running before they have completely finalized the script. And if you're doing it that way around, this is what is going to happen. What I find odd about this as well is that I can't remember if it was during the show or off air at some point, but some of the Danish TV series I've been watching in recent years, discovering that one thing the Danish network did was basically set up writing programs where they would pay a couple of producers and writers enough money for them to sit down and work out the script and the plot of the series for 6 months, before they started doing anything else. And especially given the amount of money involved in making these movies, you would hope that at some point some studio executive would realize, wait a minute, it's pretty cheap to pay writers just to sit and write. Why don't we do that first and then start on the other stuff?
Yeah, but I kind of get that. But of course, with any type of effects heavy type of film, you also have that whole problem of needing pre-production and everything else. I'm not making excuses necessarily, because certainly we've seen other films where they went way too far with the footage before there was even a script. I mean, infamously, Transformers 2 comes to mind. Not that that was ever going to be a great film, but yes. There are some clear lessons to be learned from that. And in fact, I do know there are some film classes that talk about how much of a train wreck that was. I really hope that that's not what this is, and that this isn't a whole bunch of glossing over issues to that extent. It seems like everybody is more or less positive about this. I mean, I'm sure that the people are not happy to have to work long days for weeks on end in order to quote unquote fix a film. Mm-hmm. But I don't see this as fixing it so much as I'll drink the Kool-Aid. It's enhancing the film. Please, I'm crossing my fingers, let that be the correct interpretation.
No, that is what we all hope, certainly.
Yes. It's yet another hope. Damn it. All right. That was our headliner, though, for this particular week. Let's get into our relatively short traditional network section here, and we're going to get into CBS and some news regarding the new Star Trek revival. They have hired, as one of the writers, Kirsten Baer, who has been crafting the Star Trek Voyager relaunch novel series since around 2009. And she's going to be joining Brian Fuller and the rest of the writing staff for the 2017 series. Baer has written 8 full-length novels covering the ongoing adventures of the Voyager crew after the return from the Delta Quadrant, a role she took over from novelist Christy Golden, who left the book series in 2004. And while I've had some quibbles about some of her writing choices, I do agree, as this article says here, that she has a real knack for tying disparate bits of continuity together in her novels, tying relatively obscure or one-time events from the Voyager television episodes into her writing. And hopefully she will, in fact, bring some of those same skills to the new show. I've read all of them. Well, not all of them. There's actually, is there just one of them? Yes, just one of them sitting right here. The most recent one that she put out is next on my list after I'm done with the book I'm reading now. So clearly, even though I don't really have much love for Voyager, I do have a great amount of regard for the author, because that's one of the big reasons I'm still reading them. So good choice for the writing staff, in my opinion.
Yeah, definitely. And to my mind, even though I'm not someone who's gotten into the novels very much, but I am pleased to see Brian Fuller continuing to bring in people who have a great familiarity with the Star Trek universe.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. So, yeah, exactly, right? Get a good mix. People who are coming in from the outside, people who have a real knack for that continuity, like it said here. I agree. That sounds like a really good way for them to go. But again, maybe I'm just feeling good vibes from you know, because I'm trying to keep a positive attitude about Star Wars. But the distribution model aside,
yes,
which, yeah, I'm getting good feelings about this Trek series. I really hope that I don't hear like the other shoe drop sometime soon, but there we go. Let's move over to Cable now, Edmund.
Yes, and this is news out of FX. No, not involving the Americans for once, for me. But this is about the Marvel series Legion. It has officially been ordered 2 series, an 8-episode first season slated to premiere in early 2017. And Legion is, of course, based on David Haller, who they are calling the most powerful mutant alive, a character in the comic book universe who is the son of Professor X, the founder of the X. Man, and also suffers from numerous multiple personalities, each of which has their own mutant superpower. Dan Stevens has been cast as Haller, and the show will explore his journey of discovery about himself and the power at his command. And there is a large and impressive cast: Rachel Keller, Gene Smart, Aubrey Plaza, Amber Midthunder, and Bill Irwin. And they do mention that given the nature of Haller's mental problems, it is likely that several of these performers could actually be portraying aspects of Haller himself. And in the way of the MCU, and this might sound familiar to some Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Cast and fans, the TV series will share a world with the X-Men films, but the characters may not intersect. So...
yeah. Now, this one is an interesting one for me because I really enjoyed what I believe the source material is going to be, which was I kept on saying it was a Legion miniseries or a series from a few years ago. It was actually called X-Men Legacy. I really recommend that for anyone who wants to get an idea of the quirky side that this show seems to be really invoking. And definitely it was one that I was excited to read every month or so. And yeah, I'm glad to see that it's getting an adaptation here. So let's see, as we move on to our next bit here. Yes, this is one, of course, I'm excited to talk about, at least well, half of it anyway.
Some of it, yes.
Some of it. All right, Showtime. Whoa, where did it go? It's not that variety. Showtime boss David Nevins on HBO, Homeland's Future, and Twin Peaks. Well, let's talk about the things that we actually care about here. Well, let's see. I'm scrolling. And basically, they are saying that there is a deal very close for a, get this, 3-season renewal for Homeland, which would take the show through season 8.
Yes.
Alex Ganza to remain as showrunner. Listen to this, okay? It's proven it can reinvent itself year after year. Really? Okay. Season 6 is really interesting. It deals with that miraculous moment in American democracy where when you have a peaceful transition of presidential power... Oh, wow, that timing is great for that. Mm-hmm. The entire season takes place in the 70 days between Election Day and Inauguration. When you're in that transitional time when all the instruments of governmental power are being handed from one instrument administration to another, a lot of complications ensue. Oh, and they want to put this out in January. Mm. I'm getting a headache right here, that place Jakar kept talking about, right there. Oh, aren't we going to have our own circus just wrapping up around then? Oh boy. Mm-hmm. Okay.
He
reiterated his goal to have the series series premiering monthly, revamping the scheduling strategy to make that happen. Masters of Sex will bow in September, followed by Shameless and then The Affair. So yeah, that would in fact put Homeland firmly in the January slot it all works out the way they seem to be talking about. Let's talk about something better. Twin Peaks. It doesn't get a whole lot of talk here, but it has been reported in several different places that they are looking for it to premiere in the second quarter of 2017. Production's completed, and David Lynch is now in the editing room, no doubt turning it into something that people will be talking about for years, trying to understand exactly what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to love every minute of that discussion anyway. Maybe not the series. We'll see. But talking about it, yes, we're going to enjoy that.
Yes. And why do I automatically think when I see think David Lynch in the editing room, I'm assuming it's dark. There's red velvet. There's a midget dancing around.
Yep. Harkening back to 1990. Anyway, anyone who knew me back then knows that that was a series that was formative, to say the least.
I just have to mention this whole thing with Homeland. It just really feels like they are taking the same approach that they did with Dexter when they managed to completely run that series into the ground.
Mm-hmm. I feel like they really should have let it be done. To be honest, that last season, as I recall, and I can bring that up as we sit here and talk, the last season was a bit of a quote unquote return to form.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
as things go, maybe not that much of one, but it was really the last two seasons seemed to be better. I mean, we had that really bad one,
mm-hmm.
but last season I recall being actually fairly good. Maybe not, you know, first and second season good, but certainly nowhere near season three bad.
No, well, yeah, no. Season three, where they were beating the Brody Horde literally to death. But yeah, I mean, you know, with season five, there was a sort of you know, they were at least getting, you know, not getting back to the show's version of Spycraft, but at least the showrunners' versions of Spycraft.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I mean, it was getting back to what we kind of started off with in theme, at least. Not nearly as, what's the word I'm looking for here? Not nearly as novel as that first season or two was.
Yeah.
Now that they're beyond Brody, maybe we are okay, or at least better off. But three seasons? Okay. They better have lots of Twin Peaks to make up for that. Let's just put it that way. All right. Quite frankly, I mean, they say that they're in a great position to compete with channels like HBO and Stars and so forth, but quite frankly, I don't know. They have a tendency to have shows that start off really strong and then fall off.
Mm-hmm.
Masters of Sex, it was mentioned in the article, that's one where used to be getting high praise, and now, quite frankly, I don't even know if when the new season comes out it's going to be worth our time.
Absolutely.
And that's mostly based on what you've said. So, yeah. It can take a real fast drop, but as you said, the Dexter syndrome. Maybe that's the way to put it. I'm not sure. We'll see. All right. Let's go ahead then and move on to some better news for those who are fans of this next particular show.
Speaking of Stars, we have news that Outlander has been renewed for both seasons 3 and 4. This is news coming as the second season has made it up to its 8th episode. Amazingly, season 3 will be based on the 3rd of the 8 Outlander books, Voyager. Season 4 will be based on the 4th, Drums of Autumn. Stars CEO is naturally praising the show, saying Outlander is like nothing seen on television, from its depiction of a truly powerful female lead character to the devastating decimation of the Highlander way of life, to what is a rarely seen genuine and timeless love story. Actually, I did not realize this. Yeah, no, this is actually the 25th anniversary of the publication of the first book. So quite a legacy for this series.
I know a lot of people that are that really enjoy the show, that are fans of the books, enjoy the show, even though they make very big changes in order to make the adaptation work. Right now, I haven't seen the second season yet. I'm kind of letting them pile up so that I can binge watch them over the summer. But what I've heard is that it is still maintaining its quality, and there's a lot of fear as to exactly how they could adapt these books in single seasons, even going forward. There was a great deal of celebration. There wasn't any of the kind of reactions like we just had about Homeland getting three seasons.
Yes.
This was much more anticipated. Let's see. What's next on the list? We are moving into then movie news.
Movie news.
Yes.
Naturally, if we're going to talk about movies, I guess we need to talk about reboots. Because we now have news that 20th Century Fox is apparently set to once again try and make a movie out of The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Of course, this is after the 2003 adaptation, which did not get a great reception. I still find it fun to watch on a Saturday afternoon when you happen to cross it on HBO or somewhere like that. Of course, this was after the first film did such things as adding Tom Sawyer to try and make it more and more American and not just have all those British literary characters. In fact, was described by the New York Times as having the sweat stains of wasted energy. It's dreary yet frantic. Let's see. At the moment, we have no cast, we have no directors, we have some producers. John Davis, through his Davis Entertainment banner. Jason Rothwell has been hired to write it. And that is as much as we know at the moment. So just fingers crossed that maybe this will work out better than the first time.
I know some people that will defend that movie, or at least to some degree. I know that there are people who enjoy it, but what are you going to do? All right. I got to say, this isn't, again, my theory as when is a reboot or a remake justified when you have a film that it was considered to be imperfect and could have been done better. Sure, go for it. What's the worst that could happen? It'll be, you know, just as derided or disliked. Okay. Anyway. Moving on then to an adaptation, and this one I'm excited about. Screenwriters Brian and Mark Gunn are officially writing a film adaptation of the hit comic book series Jupiter's Legacy from writer Mark Millar and artist Frank Quitely. It was announced last year that Millar and the producer had partnered to develop an adaptation, but no updates had been released until now. The Gunns met with Millar yesterday and are currently hard at work on the screenplay. For those who aren't familiar with this series, and there's the Jupiter's Legacy series and the prequel series Jupiter's Circle, which is also very good. It's a story of a world filled with superheroes where the next generation decides to overthrow the status quo, seizing control of the United States by force in an ill-advised attempt to improve the world around them. The comic series reflects both on the superhero genre and the nature of hope in the face of overwhelming problems, as well as the changing perspective between generations. So yes, it's actually quite a good one. Have you checked this one out, Edmund, by any chance?
I have not. This one has escaped my notice, but yeah, you seem to be adding to my reading list again.
Yeah. I have a bad habit of doing that. Or a good habit, depending on how you look at it. Nice thing about it is that Millar usually puts out these series in like 6-issue chunks.
Yep.
So he tells a story and then he kind of moves on. And each 6-issue arc is pretty pretty well established. All right. Next up, this surprised me when I saw this.
This is news about that wonderful movie Moon from a few years ago. Good Lord, it actually has been 7 years now. It appears that Duncan Jones has actually intended this movie as the first of a trilogy. He said, let's see, yeah, the new project is Mute, sci-fi, naturally, set in the same universe. Versus Moon. He said in an interview, "I've always wanted to make Mute, and I've been on Mute for about 14 years. I'm determined no matter what happens, I'm going to get that movie made at some point." Yes, he's calling it the Mooniverse. There is this third part, which has been written, although no concrete plans to actually make it yet. For Mute, it is ready to go. Female lead. Interestingly, he was trying to get it made after Source Code came out, but 4 or 5 years ago, it was apparently really difficult to get a film made that was science fiction with a female lead. I don't know, executives not old enough to have seen Aliens, maybe? Or you would have thought they would have grown up with it. But unfortunately, given all the issues with Mute being made, we should perhaps not get too excited about the third movie. Jones was saying Mute's kind of happening now, so I'm going to do that. Then, with any luck, I'll get to make this other film as soon as possible. But given the 7 to 8 year time difference between Moon and Mute, I really like the idea of there being more movies in this universe. I hope it doesn't take as long for the third one.
Yeah, I know. Although this does give people time to catch up and actually watch Moon. Yes. If you haven't watched it, go do so.
Absolutely.
That is the Duncan Jones film you want to see.
Yes.
Not this other thing that's coming along. Anyway, you were going to say or add to that?
Yeah, no, and I was going to say, and also if you haven't watched it recently, it's a movie you can definitely watch more than once, as I've discovered.
Indeed. It does hold up on repeated viewings, for sure. All right, and that means we can move on to casting news. That's right, and we're going to jump right into a film that we are all very happy to know is coming, and that is Kingsman: The Golden Circle. We are all looking forward to that, and it has just added yet another member to its already impressive cast. Jeff Bridges has signed on to star in the sequel. He made the announcement over the weekend, or last weekend, on Twitter. "The only Golden Circle I want vexing me is the one my glass leaves behind on the table," the poster accompanying Bridges' tweet reads, suggesting his character may be on the side of the Kingsmen rather than on the side of the presumably nefarious Golden Circle. Unless the Golden Circle... We don't know much about it, so... all speculation. But what we do know is that in the sequel to the 2015 spy adventure film, Eggsy and Merlin will head to the U.S. to join up with the American counterpart of the Kingsmen, the Statesmen, after Kingsmen HQ is destroyed by the villainous Poppy. Colin Firth and Edward Holcroft will be returning for the sequel, and there will also be new cast members Channing Tatum, Halle Berry, Elton John, and of course now, Jeff Bridges.
Very good news.
Yes, indeed. Very, very good news. All right, next on the list is some news about another greatly anticipated adaptation.
Absolutely. This is a new addition to the cast of Ready Player One. T.J. Miller, of course, currently starring in HBO Silicon Valley, last seen on the big screen in Deadpool, will be joining the cast. I'm just going through here. Here we go. Miller will be playing IROC, an annoying troller in the online forums of the game. And certainly anybody who's been watching Silicon Valley knows that he should be able to do that very, very well. Movie itself is heading towards a start of production in late June. For those who haven't read the book or heard us talk about this previously, the story is set in a virtual world called Oasis, in which a teenager played by Ty Sheridan finds himself competing in a treasure hunt against ruthless foes after the reclusive and enigmatic founder, played by Mark Rylance, of the game dies and offers his fortune as the grand prize.
Mm-hmm. And definitely looking forward to that one. And good to know that they are continuing to flesh out that cast. And also getting another adaptation. Reboot? How do you want to put it? I'm not sure. Edmund?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just staring into this clown's eyes and getting hypnotized there.
Yeah. Don't let that happen.
Yes. So as some of you might be guessing, this is news of the new adaptation of Stephen King's It. It is casting news that Bill Skarsgård, one of those Skarsgårds, that rather large, I believe, Swedish acting family, has been tapped to play Pennywise the Clown, of course, the villainous lead role in It. Don't necessarily get too excited. It's not the first time this role has been cast. Will Poulter was originally given the role, but had to exit after creative differences prompted the original director, Cary Fukunaga, to leave. Assuming the Mr. Skarsgård and the current director, Adam Muschietti, can see eye to eye, then presumably things will finally be getting underway on the adaptation of It, which, just in case you were worried about what they were going to be able to portray, will in fact be rated R.
Mm-hmm. I would certainly hope so. Let's see here. Next on the list is why? Okay. yes, Anthony Hopkins has joined or will be joining Transformers: The Last Knight. Okay. I don't know. Maybe he needed to get some renovations done on a mansion somewhere. But at any rate, there's no details about what character he's going to be playing, but the announcement was made via the Transformers Twitter account. Hopkins is also recently announced as reprising his role as Odin in Thor Ragnarok. Or will it
Which,
be Odin?
Yes. Which Odin, yes.
Indeed. Anyway, Hopkins is not the only Brit joining the cast of the new Transformers film. Director Michael Bay has tweeted plans to include the so-called loneliest dog in Britain in The Last Knight. Oh, God. Okay. The dog, whose proper name is Freya, appropriately enough, gained the nickname after spending nearly her whole life in a shelter in Liverpool. They promised to include the dog in the film, either find her a home or adopt her himself. Okay, that I'll give him credit for, but
okay.
You're going to put Anthony Hopkins and the dog named Freya on the same. Okay. Michael Bay, what are you doing? Raking in millions on these films, that's what he's doing.
Yeah, yeah. I'm certainly having much more fun just imagining Anthony Hopkins channeling Tom Hiddleston. So,
that's, yeah. That's a much more pleasant thought. That's a pleasant thought to keep in our mind as we grieve, not just for Muhammad Ali, as we kind of alluded in our opening, but also this next piece. Edmund, take it away.
Yes, this is an unfortunate in memoriam from the world of anime. Kiku Futaki has passed away of unspecified illnesses. She was only 58 years old, but she's been an animator for a impressive list, primarily at Studio Ghibli, where she worked with the great maestros Takahata and Miyazaki, but was basically the one breathing life into such characters as Kiki, Sophie, Princess Mononoke, also the Jirinko Chi very early on, which is a bit of a short but a wonderful one involving a cellist, and has basically been involved in pretty much every Studio Ghibli film since Nausicaa back in 1984. And also had a hand in Akira, Royal Space Force, and just one of the great talents of Japanese anime. Got her start, surprise, surprise, as an in-between animator in 1979 on an episode of Lupin 3, which of course Miyazaki did contribute to some directorial work too, and has also been well known as an illustrator, especially for her drawings of Nahoku Yuhashi's Mirabito novels, and just a sad loss for anime.
Absolutely, it's been a tough year. It's been a really tough year. All right, let's go ahead then and switch gears here, and we'll talk about what the bottom three shows were for this past week. And now this is what's interesting.
Yes.
Before we get too far, is that all of the shows this week were average or above, but there is almost a full point difference between the bottom three here. It's 3/4 of a point, but that is a big leap. So most of the material this week was of fairly high quality, and yeah, this is just kind of surprising. That it means that a couple of the shows here really aren't bad at all necessarily, mm-hmm. or certainly not relatively speaking. It's just that they happen to be at the bottom of the list. So it's worth noting, I suppose, before we go any further. And just in case, Edmund, I just really just need to hear that one more time.
Yes, if you haven't seen these episodes, you will probably be spoiled by something or other that we say.
That's right. That's right. All right. Well, let's go ahead and get into the first show on our list. And again, this comes in at a 7.75. That's hardly a bad score, but it is in the bottom three. The Musketeers, season 3, episode, or series 3, excuse me, episode 1, Spoils of War. Athos, Porthos, and D'Artagnan have been at war while Aramis has been at the monastery caring for the children left orphaned. Missing munitions brings the three to the monastery where the bad guys have taken refuge. As they scheme to stop the stolen munitions from being sold to the Spanish and save the monks and the children, Aramis is forced back into battle and has to decide where he truly belongs.
I wonder where.
I can't imagine. It really doesn't change anything because it's still a pretty good, solid start to the season.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, it was a pretty dense one. It's darker than what we've seen before, but from what I understand, since this is the final run, the final series of for the Musketeers, they really are going to be ramping up some of the darker parts of the story, and they're not holding back because they don't need to anymore. So supposedly there's going to be a lot more variation and interesting twists and turns with the storytelling. So I was quite happy with it.
Oh, yeah, no, and I thought they did a remarkable job, I mean, of both mixing the action sequences that we've come to expect from the program. I mean, you know, we actually open up with a full-blown battle, but with the sort of catch-up and exposition, since they have actually jumped ahead. I was rather shocked when it actually came up 4 years from where we left everybody. But I thought they did a really good job of squeezing all that stuff into the story while establishing the new villain. I must say this is a case where it's a good thing that they actually do show the pictures of all of the different characters as the actors come up, because I never would have guessed that was Rupert Everett as our new whatever he is, commander of Paris and commander of the Red Guard, who's obviously going to be their nemesis. The continuing saga of the slightly ineffectual king and all these powerful people around him trying to take advantage of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like you said, some of the people that are in this particular season, very surprising, their appearance and the kind of character that they're playing. They seem to be very, very, very happy playing things a little more arch. It's a little bit fun, I guess.
Yes.
All right. Coming in second on the list here, we have Winona Earp, Season 1, Episode 9, Bury Me With My Guns On. A shaken Winona seeks solace in drink and other questionable activities after her encounter with the Last of the Seven. Eventually, she finds herself joining Henry in his vendetta to find and defeat the woman who wronged him. And I gave this one a 7.5. It's a little bit of a backslide from last week, for sure, but I've really kind of appreciated the fact that the plot has been moving forward, and it's growing on me slightly. Not enough for me to really be like, you know, pounding down the door to try and watch it every week, but it's at least entertaining me now. I'm not giving it a recommendation yet, though. I promise.
Okay.
But that brings us to our bottom show for the week, and this would be another premiere. Wayward Pines, Season 2, Episode 1, Enemy Lines. In the Season 2 premiere, Dr. Theo Yedlin, awakens from suspended animation and finds himself in the middle of a rebellion in Wayward Pines. And yes, this one came in at an average 7. And Gary actually gave this one a 7, saying, I don't know if they can make this work. And yeah, just based on this one episode, I was really quite disappointed with the step backwards from the first season, which I feel like... maybe this new character is the problem, or maybe it's because they did a little bit of a time jump. I don't know, but I found it hard to invest in this. What do you think, Edmund?
Yeah, I mean, I was just found this very, very difficult to get into. I think part of it is, I mean, it really feels like we've gone from the first season which had its problems, but now that they've done their big plot twist from the finale of focusing on the first generation taking over, it really feels like we've gone from sort of the adults battling each other in season one to now you've got these somewhat naive and ineffective kids taking over, and with Hope Davis still egging them on from her wheelchair, I was almost getting the sense of Fox executive sitting around going like, oh yeah, this Divergent and Maze Runner series seem to be doing okay, can we do something like that? And as you know the neither of those series has really taken off that well, and certainly in the public consciousness. And I am not finding much reason to stay interested in this one either.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. Should it have maybe stayed a one-season event series? I think maybe that would have been the ideal situation. But this episode, this premiere, could have suffered from the fact that they did go from thinking of this as a kind of one-story arc series to what it is now.
Mm-hmm.
They do have to bridge somehow into something else, and we'll see. Maybe this is just quote-unquote growing pains. But yeah, not the strongest of starts. Okay, that being the case, what we're going to go ahead and do, this is a little bit of a shorter show, but we're going to go ahead and wrap this one up here. When we come back next time, we're going to get into the top three, and then the rest of the episodic discussion will come along, and I'm sure somewhere in there will be a nice big chunk of Westeros. So until next time.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google Plus, under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as fair use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the Critical Myth.